Hi, y'all. I'm Elizabeth, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 29th of 2000. My home group is Outlaw Safe Crackers in Richmond, Virginia. I have a sponsor, and I am a sponsor, and those are the most important things in my life, my sobriety date, my home group, and the fact that I'm in a sponsorship chain, because they help change my life and give my life new meaning. And first thing I'd like to say is thank you so much to Sam and to Billy for asking me to come up or come down. I don't know which way we came, but we came some way. And we came in a van full of sober alcoholics. And I'll tell you, that is one of my favorite things to do is to take road trips with alcoholics, because we get to talking and anything and everything comes out of our mouth, and it's fun. And so I'm grateful that I'm here. And before I start, I always like to make sure that I tell those who may be new in Alcoholics Anonymous that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life that I didn't even know that I deserved or that I even knew that I wanted. But my life is beyond my wildest dreams, and I'm so grateful for every moment that I get to breathe a sober breath. And I definitely 100% have a higher power as a result of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and with the help of the many sponsors that I've had in sobriety. And also, I have definitely had a spiritual experience as a result of the steps, you know, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and if you are anything like me, I'm here to tell you that you can too. And that is, you know, that's the biggest piece of hope, you know. But it's true. You can have a life beyond your wildest imagination. It might not be what you want. It might not come in the form of material things. But on the inside, I will tell you that my life is brimming over with happiness and peace that I never even knew was existent before, you know, I started on this path. And I'm going to tell you in a brief way what it was like, what happened, and what my life is like today. And I have an hour. I will tell you that I was born and raised in a home group that only spoke for 30 minutes, and I've learned how to speak a little bit longer, so I'm hoping that we will be able to make the whole hour. But I will tell you that was not how I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, so please bear with me. Okay, I was born and raised in a small town in Southern Virginia. Billy wanted me to talk about it. Martinsville, Virginia. My parents are still married. I have three sisters. My older sister is 5 years older than me, and I have twin sisters that are 7 years younger than me. And none of them are alcoholic. And my parents, I don't know if I said this, but they're still married. And I was born and raised in a Catholic family, and my mom, you know, wanted to instill good values in me, and she took me to church every Sunday. And And I will tell you that from the moment that I remember, I have always felt different. I've never felt like I belonged, and I didn't, you know, I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew that something was. And when I was in kindergarten, I was doing silly things like cutting my hair in the bathroom and blaming it on cat hair. It was actually a dare from somebody else, and I walked out with, you know, bald spots on my head, and, you know, and like in kindergarten, doing things like that just to get attention and to be accepted by others. And you know, and that's the way that I was. And for many years in the beginning, I really I lived in a way that didn't reflect how I was to end up. You know, I had dreams. I was 11 years old, and my grandmother took me to the adult daycare center, and I learned that I wanted, at 11 years old, what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, and that was to take care of senior citizens and to help create a life for them. And when I took that drink, I gave it away. You know, in one sip of alcohol, I gave that dream away. You know, I had dreams of being a good sister to my little sisters and to be an example. I'm 7 years older than them, you know, and I thought that I had an opportunity to really help in a way that, you know, a lot of my friends didn't, because they were so close together in age. But I had 7 years on these little girls, and I could be an example. No, I gave that away. I had, you know, dreams of, you know, making my parents happy and, you know, getting married and, you know, and leading a, you know, a normal life, you know, doing the things that my parents had shown me how to do. And one drink alcohol, you know, I gave that away too. And for me, what happened is I, in the seventh grade, I ended up failing a test. And that test put me in special education. And I've always been somebody that has not really liked to comply with the rules. They tell me to zig left and I zig right. It's always the way I've been. And and this test was to write this story on this specific subject, and I decided to write it on something else. And because I made the choice to do that, it put me in special education. And from that moment until, you know, until recently, because my sponsor helped me learn how to have, you know, respect for myself and just, you know, to do right. I made the choice that I was never gonna, you know, try to make good grades again. I just didn't care anymore. It was like, in that instant, I remember getting into my, and finding out that I had failed the test, and getting into my mom's van, sinking into the seat where nobody could see me, and bursting into tears. And that's the moment I gave up. Like, I just didn't care anymore. And in seventh grade was also the time when I took my first drink. I went down in the basement with a friend of mine, and she decided that we should try my daddy's nasty, wet lip cigarettes from the night before. He lipped all his cigarettes because he didn't have any teeth, so he couldn't really. That's just the truth of the matter. And he lipped his cigarettes, and I would smoke them in the basement, and we would drink his old beers and, you know, old alcohol and wine and stuff. And I remember mixing blue Kool-Aid with red blush wine out of the bottle. And at first, you know, my intentions were, and this is what I thought was happening, is that I was going to learn how to drink like I saw my parents drinking. And I really had the idea that this was going to be a social thing and that it was going to be cool and, you know, and I could drink, you know, and have fun and, you know, and I thought that socializing meant bringing alcohol, and by the ninth grade, all of that changed for me. So I was drinking, and you know, in the basement for 2 years, and I went into my freshman year in high school, and I went to my first party, one of those house parties, with the first live rock and roll band, the first kegger, the first tiki I gave to a boy on his neck, and the first blackout that I had ever experienced. And from that day until October 29th of 2000, I chased the blackout. I wanted the blackout. That's all I wanted, because when I had the blackout, I didn't have to deal with life on life's terms. I didn't have to feel the uncomfortability and the angst that I have on the inside. I didn't have to feel different from you. I didn't have to remember or take any kind of responsibility for my life. And so I chased that blackout. And so I had that first drink, and I met a boy, and we started dating, and he was 21, and I loved old Jason. He was a good guy, and he never did drugs in his life. And I'm sorry, I do have to tell you that drugs are a very minuscule part of my story, and they do have helped me hit my bottom. So you're going to hear a little bit about them, but I will tell you that I am 100% wholeheartedly an alcoholic, because no drug ever took me to the blackout that alcohol did. So I. Very small part. But anyway, he made a deal with me, and the deal was that if I didn't smoke marijuana and dabble in the little bit of drugs that I wanted or that I was dabbling in, that he would buy me alcohol anytime I wanted. And you know, and I thought that was a pretty fair bet, and I continued to smoke a little bit of marijuana behind his back and do what I wanted to behind his back, and we dated for 6 months, and Jason found out that I was smoking marijuana, and he gave me that ultimatum again, and I found it very easy. I chose him and the alcohol, and I used that man to, I mean, so badly, and I learned how to be a user of people and a taker of things, and, you know, and so Jason and I started dating, and I covered up my life through doing things for the community, like volunteering at the Adult Daycare Center that I mentioned earlier, and I became a crisis intervention hotline person, and I volunteered as a 4-H camp counselor, and, you know, and I did all these things, and somehow the United Way decided, my mother wrote a letter to the United Way, and they decided that I was my town hero, and so it was a really good way to get under, you know, to get by, to skate by and do what I wanted to do, and, you know, and it was my ploy, it covered it up, you know, I masked it with these attributes that I had, and I was asked in 1996, which was when the Olympics were in Georgia, to carry the Olympic torch, and so I was doing things like carrying the Olympic torch and behind people's backs, and behind the system, I was drinking as much as I wanted, as often as I could, and hurting the people that that I cared most about, and So Jason and I dated all the way through high school, and then I got out of high school, and he just couldn't deal with it anymore. He didn't drink like I did, and he just didn't know how to deal with someone like me, and he broke up with me, and he fell in love with my best friend, and he told me, and in a drunken rage, I beat him up, and then I wiped my hands of him, and I decided that, you know, now I no longer had a way to get alcohol, so I needed to come up with something really quickly, and I met this girl, and she drank a little bit worse than me. Like she always seemed, trouble always seemed to follow her, and so I could kind of use her as my, you know, way to skate underneath, you know, underneath the radar and do what I needed to do, and so Heather and I joined forces, and we were inseparable. We were the team to, you know, we were doing whatever it was that we needed to do to get alcohol, and we made a pact, and the pact was that we would do whatever it meant, and women, and hopefully you guys are kind of following this trend, and, you know, I was hurtful, and I hurt a lot of people, and I did what I needed to do to get alcohol, and my mom got scared, and so she decided that it would be a good idea to fill out an application. I'm going to close this book because I'm scared I'm going to break it. To fill out a college application for me and to VCU. And so she filled out an application, and she made sure that, you know, that I could go to VCU. And in the middle of the semester, I swept away to VCU and out of Martinsville. And I was so excited because I felt like I had, you know, I'd finally had a geographical cure that would maybe help cure me, and maybe I could get, you know, back to where I had, to the hopes and dreams that I had when I was 11 years old, because they were gone. You know, I was living for alcohol, and I will tell you that when I didn't have alcohol in my body, I was doing things like setting my bedroom on fire, and literally set my bedroom on fire, and you know, and hitting my little sister with the telephone in the head, and you know, she brought that up to me when I made amends to her, and you know, like, just I just was not a kind person, and I was so uncomfortable on the inside, and you know, and I just did not fit in my body, and you know, and so I thought this new geographical cure would you know, it would help me, and I was sadly mistaken. I got up there and found a guy that drank like I did, and I moved out of my dorm and into his within 2 weeks. And I thought he drank like I did, and you know, his house was full of alcohol. I drank a lot of gin and tonics back then. A lot. I liked a little bit of tonic with my gin, and you know, and he got scared. And by the end of our relationship, I remember it as plain as day. He was dragging me by my neck down the street to the to what now I know it's the Commons. It's called the Commons, and that's where the counselors are. And he took me to a counselor, and he explained to them that I had an alcohol problem. And then he left. And when he left, I explained to the counselor that, you know, I don't know why, you know, it's not me that has the problem. It's him. Don't you understand that when I put alcohol in my body, that I feel comfortable, I feel happy, I feel like you do when you don't have alcohol in your body. You know, I can actually suit up and show up for life when I have alcohol in my body. I can, you know, I can socialize with people. And she said, I can't, there's nothing I can do for you. But if you ever decide that you want help, that there's a place for you. And I said, thank you, and laughed in her face and left. And by the end of that semester, none of the things that I told her were actually happening for me. I wasn't suiting up and showing up, and I wasn't social. And I got a W for every one of the classes, or an F, because I couldn't suit up and show up. So I wasn't invited back to go back to VCU, and I had to get back home to Martinsville with my tail between my legs. And by that time, I had found out that Heather was doing some shiesty stuff behind my back with the boy that I liked, and so I couldn't hang out with her anymore. So I had to find another way to get my alcohol, and so I met this guy, and this guy had one eye, a big afro, and he was the town drug dealer, and he sold out of a trailer park, and they called him One-Eyed Tony, and so me and One-Eyed Tony quickly became acquainted because I needed to get what I needed to get. And to this day, I have no idea of what he sold. I don't know. I used to tell people that I think he sold crack, but I don't know what he sold because I think that the reason why is he knows how I drank, and so if I got a hold of his supplies, then you know I would take his supplies, you know, and he wouldn't have anything to sell. So when we hooked up, he bought me alcohol like I needed. I think I was 20 at the time, so I was getting close to turning 21. And my last year drinking was complete, utter H-E double hockey sticks. It was awful. I don't want to cuss. But it was awful. One-Eyed Tony was buying me alcohol. He got scary. He would sit in my car and he would watch me while I worked, and to make sure that I wasn't doing anything, you know, behind his back, because he couldn't trust me, and it started to scare me. And so I broke up with One-Eyed Tony, and I my best friend from high school was the tallest guy in the class. His name was Andrew, and I was the shortest girl in the class, and we decided to get an apartment together, and that lasted a very short time. By that time, alcohol had really quit working for me. The voices in my head were so much louder than the alcohol. I would pour alcohol in as fast as I could, and I was a miserable drunk. I wasn't fun to be around. I would cry every single time I had an ounce of alcohol in my body because it just didn't work anymore. It just had quit working. So Andrew and I were living together, and I found who I call my alcohol sponsor. His name was Matt, and his mother was my 10th grade English teacher. And Matt and I started dating, and Matt and I dated up until my mother had me enlist into the United States Air Force and take my second geographical tour. So I enlisted, and Matt was this hippie guy that had dreads and, you know, was completely against any idea of me going into the military. And as soon as I went into basic training, he quit talking to me. But we lived together up until then, and I would drink every single night, and I would try to black out, and the blackout was happening further and fewer between. I had built up a tolerance to the point where, like I said, the voices were louder than the alcohol, and I couldn't pour enough in. I enlisted in the United States Air Force, and it took me 7 months to go into basic training. Wow. Okay. 7 months to go into basic training, and I got one of the most prestigious jobs that you could get in the military. I was a cardiopulmonary respiratory lab technician. That was what I was going to go and do. And what that means is that I was going to be able to work closely with physicians and cardiac doctors and do open heart chest surgeries and, the blue tubes that come out of people, when they're on their last leg. I was the person that would be setting those up for them. And, I felt like, that was a pretty awesome job. Maybe this time I got the right formula. Maybe this time, I'll start to feel comfortable in my skin and I'll be happy again. And, I go into basic training, and within 2 weeks I get hospitalized because my heart just can't take it. It's, doing some crazy stuff. And I know today that was me detoxing from alcohol. The alcohol was just yanked out of my body. And, and it took 2 extra weeks to get out of basic training. I couldn't run. I had no idea how to do any physical, anything. And so I was asked to stay 2 extra weeks in basic training, which was awful. And remember how I told you guys that I'm really not good with authority and when people tell me to zig, I zag? Well, the day that I graduated from basic training, my father had flown, this might get me, my father had flown to Texas to see me graduate, and they had us do a flight, like we had to march in a flight through our graduation, and I decided to skip. And what that meant for me is, my commander came up to me and told me that I wasn't allowed to visit my father because I had disgraced the Air Force. And, so I didn't even make it out of basic training without getting in trouble. And, my father came to Texas and he spent the entire time in his hotel room. And I was in trouble, and that's the kind of kid I ended up being, and that really gets me, because my father has done everything that he could, to try to help me be a better person, and I just took all of that and threw it away, because alcohol and, doing the things that I needed to do were more important than being a daughter, and so I get out of basic training, and I go home for 2 weeks. They give me a 2-week thing, because my class had already started because I was 2 weeks late graduating in the first place, so I had to wait for the next class to open. So I got 2 weeks off, and I went home, and I, returned to drinking, and I returned to Matt, the guy that I was dating before, and we hooked up, and we drank, and we were hanging out and stuff, and I was showing up to my little cousin's first birthday party drunk and carrying him around at this birthday party and just acting like a complete, irresponsible person and just causing damage everywhere. And something else I want to tell you before we go any further is my best friend in high school had cerebral palsy, and she was in a wheelchair, and we were friends from the eighth grade until, I have a lot of best friends, but this is another one. We were friends from the eighth grade until now, and she hired me for a short period of time to be her personal caretaker. And I couldn't show up for that either. I would go to her house drunk, and I would sit on her couch, and she would need to go to the bathroom. And I was so drunk that I couldn't even carry her to the bathroom, which was what I was being paid to do. And I would, I fell on her one time, and I helped her bruise her spinal cord. And, that's the kind of friend I was, and I was getting paid to do that. And so anyway, back to the Air Force story. what happened? I'm sorry. Okay, so I'm going to my tech school. I'm going to be a cardiopulmonary respiratory lab technician, and so it's time for me to go, and I get there, and I find the people that drink and smoke and party in their uniform and hang out and, and don't listen to the rules and don't conform, and they call themselves the DBA, the Dirtbag Airmen, and I became an honorary member of the Dirtbag Airmen, And I broke every rule. And I was 20 at the time. Now, remember that because this is important. And one day, I made the choice to do what I had always done. I found two guys that I thought were part of the DBA, and I'd never met them before. And so I did what I always did. I propositioned myself to go get alcohol and, you know, and do what I needed to do. And they took me off base, and some really horrible stuff happened that night. Really horrible stuff. And I can't remember a lot of it because I was blacked out. And thank God I can't remember, because that stuff is stuff that I have to work with my sponsor on a regular basis with. So the next week I can't deal with what had happened to me. And I do what I always do, because, you know, the only thing I know that can take away the pain that I have on the inside is alcohol. And so I go back to my alcohol, and, you know, and my first surgeon's waiting on me that day. And I'm coming on time into my base to go to bed. And I remember him saying, "Airman Steele," and I'm walking a pretty shaky line going into the dorm, and he said, "Have you been drinking?" And I was like, "Yes, sir, one beer." I can't tell the truth to save my life at the time. And because of that one beer, all the investigations that we had set in motion from the week before with the OSI was stopped, because they found out that night that I was drinking during that time, and they kind of changed that around on me, and they decided to put me in jail for 30 days, and I was scared to death. I was scared. I went to military penitentiary. Actually, it wasn't a penitentiary. It was a little small jail. And in that jail, you're not allowed to look at people in the face. You're degraded to, you know, to worse than worse, like you're scum. You're talked about like you're scum. You have to scream for permission to cross lines to go to the bathroom. You have to cross, like, every line that you cross, you have to scream for permission to speak to go to the bathroom. You're not allowed to talk to anyone. It's just not a fun place to be. But at the same time, while I was in that jail, I was allowed to go to the hospital. And in the hospital, there was a rehab. And I would go every single day, and I would watch movies about alcoholism. And I would sit and I would ask questions to the doctors. And I learned that there was a solution for somebody like me. And I learned that there was a place that I could go when I got out of jail and got out of all this hot mess, where maybe, just maybe, I wouldn't have to drink again. And I wanted that. I wanted it. I wanted to be sober. I got a big book while I was in jail. I met some people that were good people, and I developed relationships with them. Also, while I was in jail, at 4 o'clock every day, we would go and we would salute the flag, and we would watch the flag get taken down on the base. And the day I got out of jail, I went to the flag at 4 o'clock where everybody else was, and they were like, "Airman Steele, why are you here? Why are you here? Because the last time I checked, you were let out of jail. You don't need to be here." And I said, "The reason why I'm here is because you guys finally gave me a solution for a problem, you know, that I know that I have. And I don't have to ever do what I did to put myself in this place anymore." And they were like, "Yay!" And that night, I bought a case of beer, and I went back into a hotel room, and I propositioned myself to some other people, and I went back to drinking. Because I can't stay sober one day, okay, guys? Not one day without the first word and the first step, which is we. I can't do it. If I don't have a fellowship and I don't have a place that I can relate to other people that are like me, and to talk about, you know, the problem, and to talk about the solution, and to learn how to live the solution, I will drink again. I am powerless over alcohol, 100% powerless. But when I come to meetings like this, there's a solution. And I don't ever have to feel like I did that day. And so I go back, and I drink that case of beer, and And the next day, it's time for me to leave Texas and come back to my next base. And the next base that I'm at is Andrews Air Force Base. And Andrews Air Force Base is where all the magic happened. I hit my bottom, and I found Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is where all the magic happened. I get there, and I beg them. The first thing I do is I go to my first sergeant, my new first sergeant, and I beg him to put me back into a program where I rehab. And it's out of the hospital that I'm going to be working in. It's Malcolm Gurr Hospital, and I beg them to put me into rehab. And it takes them a couple of days, and during that time, I'm drinking and partying and stuff, and showing up to work drunk and reeking of alcohol. And I found these guys. One guy that I used to party with back in Martinsville, he was in the Air Force, and he was getting ready to be kicked out for drugs. And he found me, and we hooked up and instantaneously decided that we were going to party together. And he told me about a drug that wouldn't show up in my P-test. And I said, you know, I'm over drugs. I don't do that kind of thing. You know, I just want to drink. I just really, really want to drink to an oblivion. And so he's like, okay, let's go get a case of beer and, you know, a couple of deuces. And I started drinking, and I ended up meeting a guy that was in jail for the same reason that I was, which was underage drinking. And he was in a different, like, little jail. We ended up partying together, and you know, because we had this instant connection that we both were in jail, and we had a story to share, we ended up deciding to be boyfriend and girlfriend, and you know, of course. And that night, he after I had put a case of beer on me, you know, all bets were off when I drank. I'll tell you that. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how much I'm going to drink until I'm drunk. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen when I drink. And I have this thing that's the phenomenon of craving, and once I start, you know, it just doesn't stop. And that night, I drank about a case, probably, and he turned and he put a hit of this little pill in my mouth, and he told me to swallow it. And so I did, and he said, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you. And so this whole night, you know, I have no idea what I'd taken the whole night. All I know is that it feels really good. And, you know, and on top of the alcohol, this is a pretty awesome experience. And, you know, and then the next thing I remember is waking up. So somehow, in the middle of feeling good, I passed out and was back in my own bed. And the next thing I remember is him knocking on the door telling me it's time to go to work. And so I go to work, And he brings me a bag of gummy bears to work, and he's, you know, all wooing me and everything, and I'm so drunk. I mean, alcohol is still coming out of my pores. I'm stinking, and it's time for me to perform an EKG on the general of the Air Force Base. And, so I go to perform my EKG, and he goes, quickly, right after, he goes to tell my boss that I reek, and then that they better perform an alcohol test on me, and while they're at it, they should probably perform a drug test on me. And and so that same time, around that same time, I'm also being told that there's a spot open for me to go to rehab. And so I go into rehab, and I pee for them. I take the pee test that they asked me to do, and I'm in rehab, and me and that little guy break up because I have no idea what he put in my body, and there was just no connection except that we were both in jail, so we broke up. And I met a guy in rehab, and we, you know, of course, hit it off too because we had, you know, sobriety in common. And so we start dating, and I move out of my dormitory, of course, and move into his hotel room because he's from a different base and he's staying in a hotel room. So I just move on in there. So during that time, I get called into the OSI, which is the same guys that were investigating all the stuff that happened at the other base, and they tell me that MDMA had shown up in my blood test, which is ecstasy, and they don't look very kindly on people that use ecstasy in the military, because when you're in the military, they actually consider you military property, and they don't want you putting things in your body, foreign objects into your body when you're military property. You know, it's, you know, damaging military property. And so they decide to give me 10 years in jail, and, or they give me an ultimatum, like, either I'm going to go to 10 years in jail, we're going to have a court-martial, or you can start giving up names, and you can start telling me what happened, you know, how did this all happen. And I was 21 years old, losing my career. My parents didn't want anything to do with this crazy alcoholic daughter that they didn't know how to raise because everybody else is pretty normal in the family. My little sisters can't look up to me, and I want to die. I have an alcoholic boyfriend in rehab, and I'm so uncomfortable in my skin, and I know I'm getting ready to go away to jail for 10 years. And what do? I give them names. I start giving them names. They give me money. I go to parties, and I start, you know, trying to buy drugs for the Air Force so that other people can get in trouble. And what happened was is that apparently it became one of the largest drug busts in the United States Air Force history. And I was the first one. And you know what that means. I'm getting, you know, death threats and all of this stuff, and I'm waiting for my court-martial, and so they decide to move me off base for my protection. And also during this time, my boyfriend, remember, I'm in rehab, my boyfriend decides to drink again. And if he's going to drink again, I'm going to drink again. And so I buy a case of beer, and I have one Heineken, and he decides that he's going to go to sleep, and I pulled the cover. Alcohol's not working for me. So I have the one Heineken, and I pull the covers up over my head. And I remember saying my first real honest prayer. And that was, God, either kill me now or have something intervene in my life. And I woke up the next day, so he didn't kill me. And I go into the mess hall, just like I always do, because that's where you get your food. You get your chow in the mess hall when you're in the Air Force. So I go into the mess hall, and I run into a guy that I've been seeing at the Andrews Air Force Base meetings. And he asked me if I want to go to a young people's meeting. And I believe that he's my angel, because that's the day that I quit drinking. And I haven't had a drink or a drug or any mind-altering substances since October 29th of 2000. He got orders the next day. He was going to Japan. He delivered me to the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in AA, and he flew to Japan, and I haven't seen him since then. And all I know is that that's an angel. That is God working in my life when I can't do anything for myself. Because my last day of drinking ended up with me pulling the covers up over my head, praying to God that he kill me. And I wake up, and I'm delivered into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's, you know, there's no coincidence in that. I'll tell you another little story about how I ended up at Andrews. I had a boyfriend that was I have lots of boyfriends, but I had a boyfriend that I met on the internet, and he was stationed at Quantico. And so I had several different choices of where I wanted to go. And so I thought that I had asked them to move me to Andrews Air Force Base so that I could be closer to that Quantico boyfriend. And he got orders to Hawaii, and I never saw him again, and I got sober. Now, what is that? You know, I think that I'm doing all this, but all the time, there was something working in my life. And it's really interesting because that little bubble didn't, and it popped up when I was sitting in a rehab bringing my story to some alcoholics that were still suffering and were in rehab. And I had that bubble, and I was like, oh, my goodness, it wasn't me at all. It never was me, you know? And so I was waiting to go go to jail for 10 years. And during that time, you know, my angel delivered me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and women instantaneously gravitated towards me. And this was at Midtown in Washington, D.C. And they decided to take me to meetings and show me how to live one day at a time sober. And it took me 7 months to go to court. They kept prolonging it and kept prolonging it. And I was literally at Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 7 months just trying to get out of trouble. I was scared to death. I did not know how I was going to get to Leavenworth and stay in Leavenworth for 10 years. That did not suit me in any way, shape, or form. And what happened was that, you know, during that time that I was scared, the message started creeping in. The people were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were talking about going to the beach, and they were talking about, you know, showing up and doing service, and they were talking about all this stuff, and all of a sudden, I started to feel on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And those thoughts about me going to jail started to slowly change into, how can I do this, and how can I do that? And, you know, and by the time the court rolls around, I had already taken my fourth step. And I had gotten honest with somebody, and I told them all the deep, dark secrets. And, you know, I will tell you that my relationship with God was very slow for a very long time in the sobriety. But I go into court, and, you know, we're looking at 10 years. And, in fact, my lawyer said, you know, I don't think there's much we can do for you. And that's why I said when the guy spoke last night that you guys might have, whoever was at the conference might have heard the story already a little bit, because we have that in common. But the commander that was in charge of my court case decided, he said, we're going to give you 90 days of hard labor. We're going to take away all of your money, or two-thirds of your pay, and we're going to reduce you to Airman Basic. And I walked away a free woman. I didn't have to spend one day in Leavenworth. My sponsor at the time, he looked at me and he said, I had a male sponsor at the time. He said, now's your day to make a choice. Are you going to go back to the way that you were living? Or are you going to come join us on this fellowship? And that's the day that I took my third step, a true, honest third step. Because I'll tell you, it wasn't an easy decision. I could have very easily turned around and said, thank you. Thank you very much for giving me what I got. You know, I didn't have to go to jail. But now I can go back and do what I want to do. And I left, and I contemplated that for a little while. And somehow, some way, I left court with my boyfriend at the time. And he decided he was going to go to a meeting. And if he was going to go to a meeting, I was going to go with him. And that's how it happened. And from that day to this, you know, I've been going to meetings every single day. And my life has gotten 10 times better than the way it was that day. And I've been able to make amends to my friend, my eighth grade friend, and to the guy that I lived with. And I talk to them on a regular basis now. I pay back every penny of the money that I took working for that girl that I fell on top of and hurt. And I suit up and I show up in any way that I can. And I talk to my parents on a regular basis. And my mom almost died at Christmas. And instead of running this year, I suited up and I showed up, because that's what you guys showed me to do. She had a heart attack and two strokes, and I was at the hospital. And that's not me, y'all. That's not me. I run. I'm known, what my biggest character defect is, that I put my head in the sand and I act like an ostrich. And I don't take responsibility for my life. That's the whole reason why I chased the blackout, so that I don't have to take responsibility. And, you know, and I was able to suit up and show up for my sick mother, and she's doing so much better. But I'll tell you, that was the scariest thing I've ever been through in sobriety, and I did it. Some other amazing things have happened, and I'll tell you one. You know, I gave away that dream to get my degree and work with seniors and for alcohol. I threw that away, and I was scared to death for a long time to even vote. I was scared that I had something on my background, and so my sponsor decided that if I voted, maybe, or if we saw if I could vote, maybe I could take a job, and that was above what I was doing. Like, I was only working at retail and different things like that, because I was scared of what was on my background. And so I go ahead and I apply to vote, and I get my registration. And so then I have no reason to not apply for a job. And so I apply to a job in a nursing home, and I get it. And then I'm going to college, and I'm going to college in Virginia, and my husband and I lived in Maryland at the time, and I know I'm bouncing all over the place, and hopefully you guys are following me, but we couldn't afford to pay out-of-state tuition anymore, and so my sponsor says, why don't you look into this college where I graduated, and the first degree that pops up online is gerontology. And so all of a sudden, in May 2010, I graduate with my gerontology degree. And then, it gets weirder. My sponsor decides that it's a good idea for me to apply for graduate school. And so I apply to two colleges. I apply to Michigan, and I apply to VCU. I get into two colleges. I get a free ride to Michigan, and I get into VCU. And what is that but God working in my life? So I go back to VCU, and I make amends to VCU, which is the school that I damaged. I did a lot of damage in. And those amends, are clear. I'm suiting up, and I'm showing up, and I'm a good student, and I'm getting my master's degree. And I get to work with senior citizens, which has been my dream since I was 11 years old. And that is amazing. I've met a sober person. I'm not very good at not being in relationships. I met my husband literally the first day I got sober, and we've been married for over 10 years now. And I've learned how to have a relationship and how to suit up and how not to take from him and how to allow him to have his own separate program and to work with his sponsor. And you guys have met him, and he's spoken here, and he's amazing. And those are all just gifts of the program, But what's really happened, the best gift that's happened for me, is that I no longer have any of those nights where I want to pull the covers up over my head because it's so unbearable that I can't stand it in my skin anymore and I just want to die. That doesn't happen anymore. At 8 years sober, my life, I kind of started to sit back on my laurels, and I had made the choice to kind of stop doing the things that I was taught to do here. And my skin was getting a little bit more and a little bit more itchy. It was 6 years sober. And the drink started to sound like a good idea again. And my sponsor said to me, she said, you can either start writing from the very beginning, let's go back to step one, or you can go out and drink. You're at that place, that turning off place, And I had a sister pigeon that was sitting at my house that day, and she gave me a piece of paper and a pen. And she said, start writing. She's not sober anymore. She stopped doing what we do. But I started writing. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote, and I did my first step and my second step and my third step. And I rewrote my fourth step. And I did my sixth and seventh, and I got honest about, some of the deepest, darkest character defects that I had. I'm driven by lust, and I'm driven by, not taking responsibility for my life. And I have all these character defects, and I am riddled with them. And I ask God, every day I get on my knees, and I ask him to remove those character defects from my life. And then I go to a meeting, after this, and I'm sitting in a meeting, and someone that I got sober with, he's sharing his story. And it washes over me. The words in the big book wash over me. Either God is everything, or else he is nothing. And that's the moment I had it. I had the white light experience. And since then, I have not doubted for one second that there isn't a higher power. And there have been some really, really hard times in my sobriety, after that. I almost watched my mom die. I lost my house. Some really hard things have happened, but the thing that's carried me and sustained me is that there really is something greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And if it can happen for me, then it can happen for you. Thank you for letting me share.